Granted, our mayor. Where'd you see the mayor at?
Good old boys.
Oh, he was up there?
Yeah.
Into one of those in my life. Don't ask me.
Why?
Just.
Was that in today's paper? Was that in today's paper?
Yes.
It's changed a little bit.
Yeah.
For the better.
I never did a whole lot of that because we always had our own things going on.
Yeah.
Is it cool in here, isn't it? Oh, you got a jacket.
Thank you, Matt.
Good morning, Ms. Rich, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Good. I thought you'd been through enough of these. You could probably teach a class. We'll just wait on Councilman Musler. And here he is.
I don't guess the mayor needs this, does he?
He'll be here late. Okay, good morning, everyone. I call the meeting to order. This work session, and present is our city manager, Matthew Brower, Councilman Hilty, Councilman Molliver, myself, Council President John McLeod, Councilman Musley, Councilwoman Mary Sue Rich, and without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to our city attorney,
yep.
Mr. Pat Gilligan.
Yep.
Okay, thank you. I've given this talk probably 7, 8, 9 times in the last 20 years. I typically give it the podium turned that way, and it's filled with the boards, the various city boards and commissions that you appoint. This is the first time I've ever given it to council. I traditionally tell them a story that Ty says he's now heard 10 times. I'm going to wait on the story to see how much we have with time allotted. It has absolutely nothing to do with the topic at hand, but they say when you're public speaking, you should always start with a humorous anecdote, and that's my only humorous anecdote, but I'm going to wait on that, see if we have time, and if you remind me, I'll tell it. If we don't have time, it will be your loss. And Ty's gain, I guess, so they don't have to hear it yet again. I'm going to start first with the Florida Ethics Code. You have a handout today, and it's actually two handouts, and we're going to talk about ethics law, then the public records law, and then the sunshine law, and then some specific topics out of the charter that apply to council and the mayor and the city manager and y'all's relationship with each other. And then Jimmy will be here to talk to you about quasi-judicial hearings at the end of the program. So the first thing I want to talk to you about is the ethics law. I don't think I'm going to spend a lot of time on this, but everything in it is in chapter 119 of the Florida statutes. Now in your handout today, they're in the order of presentation, so it's got a little bit more in-depth stuff. But the first takeaway for the Florida ethics law for councilmen is that it's not criminal. It used to be criminal, where if you violated the ethics laws under chapter 119, you could actually, in theory, go to jail. And that's no longer the case. You can be fined, you can be publicly humiliated. if there's a finding by the ethics commission that you violated one of the ethics laws, you can be fined a significant amount of money, but you can't go to jail. And the ethics laws in Florida are a codification of what I think are just good sense and good government policy. They're broken down into two basic requirements, what you can't do and what you've got to report. And when the legislature passed the ethics law, they also passed a commission on ethics. What you need to know about the commission on ethics is that it's important because it does, it renders advisory opinions to public officials. Mr. Musley just was the subject of a newspaper article where we requested an advisory opinion from the Ethics Commission on his behalf about an issue that he had some concern about, given his relationship with his bank and a petitioner here before council. Whenever any of you have a, even an inkling that you may have an issue about something that you're being asked to deal with as a council or an individual councilman, what we encourage you to do is come to either Jimmy or I, and if it's something we can answer for you, we will. We will actually give you a written opinion so that you can say, look, I went to the attorneys and they asked me, and they gave me a written opinion about whether they can or can't, you can or cannot do something, or you have to take certain action or not take certain action. If we are uncomfortable doing that because it's a close question, we will request on your behalf an ethics opinion from the Ethics Commission, and you'll get an opinion, and it'll tell you what you can do or not do. And really, that's basically an olly-olly income free. It tells you what you can do and not do. So in theory, if you're vigilant about just being aware of circumstances that may potentially get you in trouble, if you just ask us first, or we have a little hink about it, we'll ask the Ethics Commission about it, and we'll assure you that you won't get in trouble. I've been city attorney now for 20 years. I take a great deal of pride in the fact that none of my councilmen have ever been formally accused of any, or informally, to my knowledge, of any ethics violations. That's one of the things I take a great deal of pride in, and so we just keep preaching. All you gotta do is ask, and we'll make sure you won't get in trouble. Occasionally, I get it. Sometimes I send them to Matt and send them around. Occasionally, I get a city attorney sort of a newsletter, and all it is a compilation of newspaper articles around the state dealing with issues pertaining to municipalities and their city attorneys. And every single issue I get has an article about some city councilman or county commissioner somewhere having an ethics complaint brought against them. And when I read what the complaint is, I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. How did you not ask somebody before you did whatever they did? I mean, they're absolutely crazy, and so avoid that. The other thing, important takeaway about that Commission on Ethics is that if you enter into a contract that may be contrary to the rules of ethics, they can legally intervene to try to avoid that contract, which probably wouldn't be good for your business or anything like that. Okay, as I said, we're on page 2, basically, if you want to follow along. The ethics code is bifurcated into two basic areas. One, what you can't do. One, and the second part is what you have to report. So what you can't do, and under prohibited actions or conduct, it has four broad things you can't do. You can't solicit or accept gifts. You can't accept unauthorized compensation. You can't misuse your public position, and you can't disclose or use certain information for your benefit. That seems like to me kind of a no-brainer. If there's something that doesn't feel right because it's something only you would be able to be in a position to get or receive or have happen for you or for a family member because of your position on council, you should probably ask yourself, does it fall under one of these four broad categories? And if it does, then, you know, first of all, don't do it, obviously, and second of all, come ask me if you can. I don't find people get in trouble for the, you know, stuff like if solicitation and acceptance of gifts. You know, that's essentially, a bribe. Now, I say the ethics laws are not criminally enforced, but the criminal laws, separate criminal laws like accepting bribes, things like that, they can be. So I've never had a problem with council doing this. I think the gray area for y'all is not the solicitation or acceptance of gifts, but it's like you have a friend that asks you to go to a Gator football game and says, hey, I got some tickets to the Gator football game. Do you can you take the tickets? Can you be a guest at somebody?
No, thanks.
Well, it does. If you look into solicitation and acceptance of gifts, it's based on the understanding that your vote, official action, or judgment that would be influenced by such a gift. So, you know, all of us have been the recipient of friends taking you to games, taking you to functions, golf tournaments, things like that, that, you know, have absolutely no relationship to, other than maybe it's a friend has an extra fourth, you know, your friend paid for a foursome on some golf tournament that for charity, and he calls you up and says, hey, I paid for this charity for the foursome, I got an extra space, do you want to play? Well, there's nothing wrong with that, because as long as it wasn't done in exchange for, by the way, since you got this free round of golf, you know, I'd sure like your support on this rezoning or something like that. Now, that being said, I have no concerns about council ever doing that. My concern is even though it's not a violation of the ethics law, is the appearance of impropriety. And just because you're cleared on doing something doesn't mean there's not an appearance of impropriety. And I think you should be guarded about that, because your reputation's everything. And once somebody, Ms. Carr, puts in the newspaper, and I'm not picking on her because she's here, it's her duty to report. But if she found out that, you know, somebody that routinely appears in front of city council, for instance, you know, on zoning matters or this or that, you know, you also went on a golf outing with them, even though there was no quid pro quo there, you've been doing that for years with that person, if she reported that, there's a certain percentage of the citizenry is going to draw an adverse implication from it, even though it's not a violation of an ethics law. That's the thing that's going to be more problematic for you. And so it just is what it is. That's what reporters report. I'm always interested in it myself, especially on the national level, when I see, you know, who's who and who's dining with the senator or the president or whatever, and who's doing this and that. And then you find out later on that, you know, they also supported their project on this and that. You know, maybe it's completely, you know, there's nothing to it other than that. But in my mind, I've sort of kind of go, I wonder if there is. So I would, as a matter, not so much of ethics, just a matter of protecting your reputation, I would, while you're on council, you might want to give a certain amount of thought before you do things like that. Yes, sir.
For instance, if... let's just use Steve Gray for example. Steve Gray invited us to go on a fishing trip or something like that, all expenses paid. That would be one that would be a little questionable, because he's routinely in front of us.
It might. I mean, it just, it would, if that got, I guess the question is that if it was in the newspaper, would you be happy about it, even if it wasn't, there was no quid pro quo there? You know, I think if somebody said, a guy bought a foursome for a charity golf tournament, which mm-hmm. that's typically what I get. Buddies of mine will call me and say, hey, I bought a foursome for, you know, the United Way golf tournament or something like that. I got an extra, you know, and he paid $800 for a foursome. You want to play? And he's not charging me a $200 for it. He said, you want to come play? I'm paid for it. You want to come play? It's on a Friday afternoon. Well, yeah, I'll come play. I've had that happen. All of us who play golf have probably had that happen to us, you know, more than once in the last 20 years. That probably, if it hit the paper, I think a lot of people would go, huh. But most people would understand that's sort of not. You know, a $2,000 fishing trip, you know, may be different. Mm-hmm. A ski, you know, a $5,000 or $7,000 ski trip to, you know, there's probably a point where you kind of go, huh, that's a little much, you know, so. It's a judgment call on your part, but if you don't want to read about it in the paper and think anybody's going to draw an adverse if you think anybody's going to draw an adverse conclusion from that, probably should err on the side of don't.
Trust me, you don't want to be on the front page of the Star Banner.
Look, my first week as city attorney. That old guy, Sue, who used to come here, the old editor, still writes occasional articles. David Cook. I'm at my very first city council meeting, and David Cook's there. Yeah, I've never met him. I've never talked to him in my life. And I tell city council, my very first city council meeting, my partner, Francis King, is representing a guy that got arrested in some by a game and fish warden over some sort of violation of hunting rules or something like that. And and somehow, some way, an Ocala Police Department officer was involved in it. And so we found out we had a conflict of interest in, on her representing that guy. Well, he'd already paid us like $1,200 for his representation or something, and he had his trial coming up in 2 weeks. So I had to tell counsel that I had an ethical, my firm had an ethical conflict because of our representation of the city, OPD officers' involvement in that particular case, and our client, but he had paid this money, and you know, would you, and it was a waivable conflict, would you waive the conflict? And counsel said, sure, we don't care, and they waived the conflict, and the gentleman had his trial, and whatever. The next day, there's an editorial about my conflict of interest in the paper, and he reported it straight. I mean, he didn't say anything, but the banner was conflict of interest, and I'm enraged because I'm like, I thought I did all the right stuff. I mean, I told counsel about it. I did everything I was supposed to. I called the bar. The bar told me what I had to do. I called counsel about it. They waived the conflict. I did everything by the letter. And I still got an editorial about my conflict of interest, so all the banner's conflict of interest. So, you know, Star Banner reported it straight, but I didn't think it was a story because there was no conflict. It was, but it was waived and did by the bar rules. So, that was my first introduction. Just because it's a good, the story's factual and it clears you of all wrongdoing, it's still a story, and people draw their own conclusions. Okay, unauthorized compensation, that's easy. Misuse of public position, that one sometimes is a little dicier. Disclosure use of certain information. That one's when you know property may be getting rezoned or you know it's percolating up and you go, you know, maybe you think it's gonna affect the value of adjoining property or something like that. You might wanna think that one through. Doing business with one's agency or conflicting employment or contractual relationships. That one comes up tangentially all the time, and once again, the solution is don't worry, is it or is it not, but call me, and we'll get you a definitive answer whether you can go forward or not. Anti-nepotism laws or certain restrictions on appointing, employing, or contracting relatives. Once again, if it's anything involving a relative, family member, and what's going on here at the city in your vote, don't do it till you talk to us, and we'll figure out whether it is or isn't. Usually we actually get a fair amount of calls from council members about those sort of things, and usually the relationship's once or twice removed, and it's usually okay. Or it doesn't inure to your special private gain or loss, so there's really no conflict, but it's better that you ask. And the other reason it's nice for you to ask is that, you know, we usually document every time you ask. We usually give you a written opinion of every time you ask. So hopefully if the Star Banner chooses to write an article, they may also ask us, well, how often do they ask? And we say, well, you know, if you release us to tell them, we'll say they ask frequently. They're concerned about the issue. Make sure they do the right thing. Voting conflicts of interest. If you do have a conflict of interest, you're not allowed to vote, and you have to announce that at open meeting at council, and you have 15 days to fill out a form that the Angel or Roseanne will give you, which they keep here, I think, in the desk, and you just don't vote. I usually get asked, even though I don't vote, can I express my opinion about the pending vote and advocate one way or the other? The answer is yes, you can. There's nothing illegal about it. My advice would be to not. And once again, I think it goes to the appearance of impropriety. But if you feel strongly enough about it, if you want to advocate it, I think you could do that. You just can't vote. Okay, that's pretty much it on ethics laws. Anybody have any questions about that? Okay. Takeaway is always call us. Okay, public records law, and a lot of people will talk about the Sunshine Law. The public records law as that they're as somehow being one and the same. They're not. They're actually two separate laws. The public records law is in chapter 119, and the Sunshine Law is kind of all over the place, but it's basically in chapter 286, as I recall. The public records law deals with public records. Sunshine Law deals with public meetings. And the public records laws mostly pertain not to what you do, but what the city does itself, staff and clerk's office and everybody that does whatever. But you do yourself create public records, and you yourself can get in a pickle over not filing what's required of the public records law, and I will talk to you about those specific issues and what to do to make sure you're okay. The way the Public Records Act starts, it starts off by saying every record that is intended to basically communicate or perpetuate any sort of knowledge or communication about city business is a public record. So they start off with this broad umbrella of everything's a public record. Voicemail's a public record, email's a public record, notes, everything's a public record. And then they say, and then the courts say, interpreting the statute, that the definition of public records is to be broadly and liberally construed. So it's supposed to be this very expansive. So if there's any doubt about it, the courts are going to say that's a public record. There are exceptions to the public record rule. And the exceptions don't say it's not a public record. It just says it's a public record, but under certain limited circumstances, you can exempt or withhold that public record for some period of time to anybody that asks for it. It's still a public record. You still have to maintain it. We're just not obligated to give it to anybody that requests it. So start off with the takeaway is start off with everything's a public record if it has any sort of information or communication, and then it may be exempt for specific reasons. A good example of an exemption would be a ongoing criminal investigation, or an investigation concerning a rape or a child sex abuse. Those are still the investigative reports that deal with those issues, ongoing police investigation, sexual assault, child abuse, things like that. Those records are still public records. The legislature has said, though, that they're exempt from production to a requester, a citizen, the newspaper, TV, whatever. They're exempt because they're obviously, there's some issues in there that the legislatures just believe should be private. You shouldn't have to be victimized twice as a rape victim or as a victim of child abuse. If it's an ongoing criminal investigation, because it is ongoing, you're still investigating, you're still talking to people, you haven't closed out the investigation, obviously you don't want the investigation in the paper until it's done, because you may tip off other bad guys and things like that. So that's a good example of it's a public record, but it's exempt from production. The issue is what agencies are subject to the Public Records Act. Well, pretty much all agencies that do any government business. So if we have private organizations that we've hired to do work on our behalf, on the city's behalf, and they create records, those records are public records. So that would include advisory boards, public entities we just create specifically to do our bidding, things like that. Occasionally, that's not something y'all have to worry that much about. It's really more for my office to worry about or for the clerk's office to worry about. But we get requests sometimes for public records, not just for something the city did, but maybe the economic, the EDC did, or people like that. And at some point in time, their records become public records, and they are subject to being given. For you as a council, here are the areas that I think the Public Records Act can most affect you. On page 8, are your emails public records? If they're about city business, they are. You email Mr. Brower, or me, or anybody else. Those emails are public records. They're kept on the server. I think the Star Banner requests them from time to time, either specifically about issues or even just in a time, I want to see all of them, so and so. So your emails are public records. I think each of you are issued your own email account, City of Ocala email account, and I suspect each of you also have private email accounts, which are other and over above the OcalaFL.org account that you have, that you just do with family friends. Some of your people that know you and deal with you quite frequently may know your private email account, not your city email account, and because they know you're a city councilman, but, you know, they may even start typing John McLeod, and what pops up is your private email account, but they're emailing you about a city matter. That even though it's on a private email account, it becomes a public record if you're discussing city of Ocala business. Now, somebody's obviously emailing, if somebody emails you on your OcalaFL.org account about, hey, John, do you want to go play golf this weekend? That's, even though it's on a public email, city-owned email account, that's not a public record. So you can have private discussions about private matters on the OcalaFL.org matter. As long as you're not discussing city business, you can still use that email account, and that won't become a public record. Now, I would suggest you do that, because it is going to go, it will still go on our server, and, you know, I'm not saying they'll ever look at it. Gazillions of them put in there probably every day for all the people in the city. I wouldn't make a habit of doing that, but if you're worried about your private emails being a public record, in theory, they're not. Your private emails on your private account discussing city business, however, are. So you got to, and that then puts on you the obligation to retain those. Does the clerk's office have a procedure set up for that? Yeah. You know, just forward them?
Yeah.
Okay. So the way you deal with that, if you get a city email, you know, John Doe contacts Mr. Hilty on email, or private email account, says, hey, I'm going to appear in council tomorrow night about this zoning matter, and I want to tell you about this and that, or want you to read these documents or whatever it is, you just immediately forward the email to clerk's office and tell them, attention, you know, just put a little note, a public record email I received, you know, today or yesterday, and I'm sending it to you. By sending it to the Ocala account, it'll get on the IT server, and we'll be in a position to retain it at that point. That'd be the same way with text messages. If you get a text message on your private phone and they text you about city business, then that's a public record. Do they have the ability to send their text to the city?
Not that I know of.
Okay. So text is a little tough.
It is.
So if somebody's texting you on your private account, or even, I don't know if you get it on your public account, but if somebody's texting you on any account about city business, or you respond to it, then you have an obligation to preserve that text somehow, some way. I don't text all that much, so I don't know. I guess there's a way to print that stuff out or convert it to an email or something like that, but you'll have to figure that out. But you have an obligation to preserve it, and so, you know, I don't care, you know, you have to take a picture of it, I don't know, but preserve the text message and get it to the clerk's office so they can store it. Facebook, Twitter, blogs, social media, those all could be potential sources also of public records. So I don't know if anybody participates in those, but if you do, be careful that you're not communicating about city business on any of those, and if you are, then make sure it gets saved, contact clerk's office, and let them know about it so they can maintain that for the public records. Under the Public Records Act, we've got a duty to maintain that, and there's a schedule that's given to us by the Division of Library Services, the Secretary of State of the state of Florida. And the retention period on all the different records is different given the type of record. Some records we have to maintain practically forever. Other records we have to maintain for 20 years. Some records we have to maintain for 7 years. Some of them are as short as, I think, 2 months or 6 months or 2 years. But that's not y'all's problem. It's the clerk's office's problem. All you got to do is get them to them and let them know you have them and just give them to them. And then you're done. You're absolutely done. But here would be the problem that I think a councilman can find themselves in, especially with these text messages or email messages, or if you have a
Facebook page. A constituent emails you a text, or sends you a text, sends you an email, or goes on your Facebook page if you happen to have one, and talks about city business, and you respond. And later on, and then you don't think anything of it, and later on, you delete the text, or you delete the email, and it's gone forever, or you scrub your Facebook page. And then later on, that same citizen makes a comment to the press, well, I told my councilman about this, and they go, yeah, when was that? Oh, I sent him a long email with all these attachments, and I sent it to him last week or a month ago, so he knew about all this, so I was surprised at his vote. Well, at that point, the astute reporter may go make a Public Records Act request for that email that this person said they emailed to you. And you didn't delete it on because any sense of malice or trying to avoid the law. You just, you're like me. I constantly am deleting my emails. Now, my emails go to a special place if they have anything to do with the city in it, because I'm obligated to follow the Public Records Act also. But, my other emails that are just from, anybody, we keep those for a period of time too. But I delete them. Text messages I delete all the time, because I just don't want them all there. I just want clogging it up. So, and so you did it just out of force of habit. And then somebody says they did it, and you're like, they come to you, well, where is it now? Well, I deleted it. So that can cause a little bit of embarrassment. And that's how, it's inadvertent, but that's how I think you can kind of get yourself a little bit of a pickle over that. We can regulate to a certain extent, but very, very little what we can get. We usually get Public Records Act requests that from the press, we usually get them are pretty specific. They know what they're looking for, and they ask for specific records. We'll get them from citizens sometimes. It'll say, basically, give us every record known to man. And and we write them back, and we go, you're entitled to every record known to man that we have as a public record, but you have to pay for it. And it's 15 cents a page, and it's going to take an incredible amount of IT technical support to produce all this for you at $17 an hour. And so here's your bill, pay your bill, and we'll start working on it. And then we usually get back, well, I really didn't want every record known to man, I just want them for this year. Okay, fine. We limit it to the year. Every email in 2009. Okay, well, every email for every city employee in 2009 is still going to cost you thousands of dollars just because of the printing cost, and we're entitled to charge for it. So usually we get the citizen just because they have to pay for it to whittle it down to what they actually really, really are looking for. And we charge them for that too. So, and if it takes an exceptional amount of time, because we've got to get an IT person, we have to have a clerk redact the records, and we're entitled to redact some records, we get to charge them for the time to do that. Okay, that's public records. Anybody have any questions about public records?
Pat, I do. What about notes? What about
sticky notes?
Yeah, if you go to... starts on page
page
9. If it's a note that you, if you're a habitual note taker and the notes are taken like at this meeting or next or council meeting, workshops, whatever, and you're just a habitual note taker, and you take notes, and those notes are purely for your own benefit later on to refresh your recollection about what happened in the meeting, those are not public records because it's not intended to communicate or transmit information to anybody else. If you use those notes, however, if you're at a meeting, you take notes at a meeting, at a workshop, let's say, and then the following council meeting, you discuss what happened at the workshop, and you have your workshop notes with you, and there's some dispute about what was said or done at the workshop, and Mr. Hilty says, well, I took copious notes at the workshop, and my notes reflect that Mr. Brower said this, this, and this.
you've now used your notes not just to refresh your recollection, you've used your notes to maybe refresh a recollection of your fellow councilman. So I think at that point, those notes then become a public record, okay? So, because that, they then, you've been used in some manner or form to communicate to other, other councilmen, those things. So that, the other question I usually get somewhat akin to that, Matt, is what about if I'm doing something in Word or some sort of word processing software, and I'm in the middle of it, am I done with it? You know, I may set it aside and come back to it later on. Is the draft, public record? Depends on how long it's a draft. I think from day to day or hour to hour, obviously no. I mean, in theory, every time you put a keystroke, the draft has changed to the next draft. Does it become automatically a public record? I think not. There's a sort of a working draft exception to the Public Records Act. But once you use that draft to communicate your thoughts to other members of the city staff or anybody else, then it was used to communicate the thoughts and whatever. And so even though it's in draft form, I think it becomes a public record at that time. So a lot of times you'll get from, especially from attorneys, they'll ask for public records, and they'll ask not only for the actual document, but also the drafts of the document, because they want to see what the thinking was leading up to the final product. You know, why did it, you know, where, how'd you go from here to there on a, let's say, a draft ordinance? Why were some things left in and other things left out? So they'll ask for that. So the drafts can be a public record if it's being used to communicate knowledge. Other questions?
So you get a text message and you just tell the person, just give me a call. We have a conversation for a half an hour. That's just, you know, that's not, I don't have to take any notes or anything like that, or I don't record anywhere about what we talked about. It's just a conversation.
Right. Your conversations are sacrosanct. If your private conversations, you absolutely do not have to reveal.
Not a private conversation about public, about city business.
No, even about city business, you do not have to reveal your conversations, your private conversations about city business with anybody. Okay. You can choose to if you want, but you don't have to. Okay. If you take notes of the conversation, those notes are not public records. If you use those notes to then say, here's my notes for my conversation with Mr. Brower, and you give them to John McLeod to, you know, let him know what conversation was, they become a public record at that point.
See, yeah. I always thought the sunshine law was just us council members, us communicating, you know, with each other. You know, that was what was triggered, you know, violating the sunshine law.
That's 90% of it.
Yeah.
But I mean, there's some nuances. There's some other requirements of the sunshine law. But right now we're just on public records, which is different than the, now, you came in a little late, but there's a difference between, I would point that out because there's a difference between the Public Records Act, which is Chapter 119, and the Sunshine Law, which is a Chapter 286. Now, they go hand in hand. Right. They were meant to go hand in hand, but they're actually two separate acts.
Okay, thank you.
Pat.
Yes, ma'am.
If an attorney, say, for instance, Steve Gray, asks us to come to his office, you know, not together. He sets an appointment for each of us.
Right.
And we talk about whatever it is he's gonna bring. He's gonna bring before us.
Right.
And you take some notes so you'll know that he's saying the same thing when he got here.
Right.
Is that public record?
No.
Because I haven't given it to anybody else.
No, if they're only for you, they're only for your use to refresh your recollection, those notes are not public records. Because you're not using them to communicate any sort of knowledge or anything like that. And those meetings with an attorney, other than Jimmy's going to talk to you about quasi-judicial and Snyder in a bit, but those individual meetings that all of y'all have with your constituents or lawyers or whatever, those are fine. You can talk to anybody in the world, and it's not subject to sunshine. The only sunshine is if you use that person who's the intermediary to be the honeybee that tells them, well, I was just, you know, Mr. Gray says, meets with Mrs. Rich, and he met with Mr. Musley, you know, an hour before, and then he says, well, when I met with Mrs. Rich, she said this, this, and this. He's put you in a bad, not that Mr. Gray would, but he's put you in a bad way because he's now communicating to you y'all's
everyone's various points of view on things. So, that's not, anything else about public records? Okay, let's go to Government of the Sunshine Law. And this is, as I said, different than the Public Records Act. This is in Chapter 286, and so, and that's on page 12 of your materials. I always tell people this because I get on my soapbox a little bit about it. I don't think the Sunshine Law, I'm wrong about this position I'm about to tell you. I think the Sunshine Law is unconstitutional. The U.S. Constitution, yes.
That's page 12.
They may have given you a PDF. It should start off with Florida.
13.
Okay, 13, I'm sorry.
It shows you were wrong, Ben.
It does. It's not the first time. The Florida Supreme Court does not agree with me about this, so, but the Sunshine Law actually precludes y'all from talking to each other outside of public meeting about government business. And that's the gist of the Sunshine Law. I'm aware of no other law in this country. And Florida's unique, by the way. I don't think any other state has a Sunshine Law. I think Florida is unique in that regard. But I'm aware of no other law that says one citizen can't talk to another citizen privately about a matter of public business. And it seems to me, it's always seemed to me that that was contrary to the First Amendment freedom of speech. I don't have, you five don't have the freedom to talk to each other about pending government business unless it's here. It just seems to me that's at odds with the U.S. Constitution and the First Amendment. That being said, Florida Supreme Court disagrees with me, and I am telling you, you are obligated, despite my personal feelings about it, because I'm sort of a First Amendment absolutist, but despite my personal feelings about it, that you have an absolute obligation to follow the Sunshine Law, which precludes y'all from talking about pending city business outside of a notice meeting. Now, the Government of the Sunshine Law, and by the way, Congress doesn't have a Sunshine Law. I mean, just as, when I say that there's other states don't have a Sunshine Law, congressmen can and do talk privately. Senators talk to senators and House representatives. They do that all the time. In fact, that's the classic back, you know, closed room, back deal, cigar filled room deals on just about everything. It's not only they do it, it's an art form. So for whatever reason, legislatures decided we're not going to do our government business that way, and so you can't. Now, even though I think it's a violation of the U.S. Constitution, I also see the very, very good effects of it. We do have government that's more transparent in Florida, more open, more this and Public Records Act than probably any other state in the country. And I think, you know, I think as a result of that, we probably have better government in Florida at the state level and certainly at the local level. So, despite my misgivings, I kind of like the end result. So the Sunshine Law requires that all your meetings be held in open and public. We have to give reasonable notice of those meetings, and minutes of the meetings must be taken. So those are the three requirements. And the Sunshine Law is just like the Public Records Law, in that the courts have said we're going to construe this law very, very broadly and very, very liberally. So they're going to be of a view that it probably is in the sunshine rather than not. They're going to start off with that way of looking at it. Any exceptions to the Sunshine Law are to be construed very narrowly, just like the Public Records Act. So that's just the way to look at it. So what kind of agencies are covered by Sunshine Law? Advisory boards, fact-finding committees, private organizations that are doing our bidding. Just about anybody that does our work are boards that are subject to the Sunshine Law. Any kind of meetings y'all have with more than two councilmen is going to be subject to the Sunshine Law. Workshops are covered by the Sunshine Law. Sometimes council appoints somebody as a representative of some sort of selection committee, and that selection committee is going to give it advice back to council about this, pick this contractor or do this project or whatever, that's subject to the sunshine law, and they have to notice it, clerk has to notice it, minutes have to be taken, and everything has to be done open and above board. The big takeaway is it's probably subject to the sunshine law until the clerk in my office says otherwise. Here are the ways y'all could get yourselves in trouble under the sunshine law. You are allowed to talk to elected members of other boards and not violate the sunshine law. Mr. Malver, recently, of course, you've talked to various school board members individually about pending litigation with the school board. Perfectly acceptable. I think, Mr. McLeod, you've been dealing with some of the folks over the county about water and sewer issues or expansion or whatever. That's perfectly acceptable. But y'all all do sit, I think, jointly on the TPO, right?
Yep.
And so you can go talk to the county commissioners individually. Individually as a councilman, you can talk to county commissioners about issues about the city and county have in common. That's not a violation of sunshine law. If it's an issue that would be in front of the TPO, though, that would be a violation of the sunshine law. So it's a transportation and planning issue that would fall under the jurisdiction of the TPO. I would counsel you not to discuss that with the county commissioner. Now, you don't have that problem with the school board. I think you probably discuss this about anything you want with the school board. The mayor, because he's not a voting member of council, can discuss issues with each of y'all individually as long as it's just one-on-one. So I would. So that's the big takeaway there, is when you're talking to other members of other elected bodies, make sure it's just so they're not in trouble. It's only one of them there. And if there are there, if there's more than one, even though you won't be the one getting in trouble, they will. I wouldn't put them in the position. I say that because sometimes you may be the person that's inadvertently in the wrong place at the wrong time. Sometimes you're at a social gathering, Christmas party, whatever, and two of you stand there, Mr. Musley, Mr. McLeod, y'all sitting there talking, having a Coca-Cola, and no Coca-Cola.
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
With maybe an adult beverage. But you're sitting there discussing it, and Mr. McLean or somebody comes up from the county, and while y'all are sitting there just minding your own business, talking about the Gators or whatever, he comes up and starts talking about a county city issue with you, and you didn't ask for it, so you'd be, you got to say, hey, you got to stop, Stan, stop doing that. There's two of us here. You can talk to me, you can talk to John. Can't talk to both of us sitting here at the same time. So those are typically, I think, are the things that I think people will get themselves in trouble in, is they're just wrong place, wrong time. Somebody forgets that the other people are subject to that. The other thing is that, go back to this appearance of impropriety. I'm years and years ago, when I first, maybe before I became city attorney, but the county commissioner, Mr. Green,
Don
Green. Don Green. He's at Sonny's eating lunch with another county commissioner, and they put his picture on the front of the Star banner, and I don't think they knew what he was talking about, but they put his picture and the other county commissioner, I think, on the front of the Star banner, and saying they were meeting. Well, so sure, they were meeting, they're having a lunch meeting. You can go to lunch with each other, and you can talk about anything you want to talk about as long as it's not city business. So the fact that he was on the front page talking to somebody and they got his picture, and it didn't make him look good, as I recall, and maybe they did overhear him, maybe he was talking about county business, I don't recall that, I don't know if he was or wasn't, but so I kind of go back to the appearance of impropriety. People are going to believe about you what they want to believe, so just don't give them an opportunity to believe wrongly about you. So if you find yourself in a public place, in a public gathering, we all are, we go to galas and we go to breast cancer awareness stuff, or dinners and things like that. We're all in public places where we see people we see daily in our jobs here as the city attorney, y'all as councilmen. You just need to be aware that you never know who's listening and they may get the wrong idea too. You know, they kept a snippet of your conversation and it seems like it's about the city or something like that. They may draw the wrong idea. You know, you may be talking about, you know, this old city football teams of past glory or something, but they hear the word city and, you know, they're thinking you're violating sunshine law. So anyway, that's something to be worried about.
Dan, how about with you?
Me, you can talk with me or Jimmy or any special counsel as much as you want, anytime, any place, as long as it's just you. If it's about city business, as long as it's just you. And then if Mr. Hilty had some, wanted to do the same thing, it'd have to be separate. We just can't do it both of you at the same time. Listen to a public meeting, and we can talk to you together.
Well, and also, you can't talk to Matt. Matt can't tell you, well, a majority of the council looks like it's going to vote this way on a certain subject. Is that right, Pat?
Correct. I call me the honeybee or the pollen bee. You can't, whether it's Matt or me or anybody else. I a lot of times about pending issues, I know I do, I'm sure Mr. Brower does. We've talked to you individually about these pending issues, and even though I don't think any of you ever say I'm definitely voting one way or the other, we get a sense from the conversation what we think, you know, you're thinking about that issue. That's perfectly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I know I don't. I'm sure Mr. Brower doesn't. You're not going and saying, hey, well, you know, I got three votes on this because I've talked to, so you just can't do that. And, you know, we're not doing it. And so, but there's no problem with you talking to us, Mr. Brower, whoever you need to talk to that you think is appropriate, the mayor, whatever, chief of police, whatever.
We just can't ask you for feedback of what you discussed with the other councilmen. And
I would love, you don't know how I'd love sometimes to tell you. I understand the human nature is you'd love to be able to do it. I think it's easier for Jimmy and I because we're lawyers, we're used to not, you know, it was part of our, just the way we conduct business as lawyers. We're used to keeping confidences, but even been a lawyer 30 years, it's still human nature. You know, sometimes you know the person you're talking to would like to know it. Mm-hmm. You can even come to the point you think they need to know it. But in that circumstance, you got to just keep your mouth shut.
Can you communicate with, communicate with other council members through the newspaper?
No.
Well, she'll print something that this councilman said, and that they're favoring this or they're favoring that, and she prints it, or whoever prints it right in the paper, what I said, what he said, how I feel, how she feels.
Yes and no. If you're doing it for the sole purpose, you don't have that problem as mayor, but the councilman do. If you're doing it, I think, for the sole purpose of letting them know how you feel about something.
No, you're just asking, you're answering a direct question by a reporter.
I don't think that would be a violation of sunshine law.
You know, her article tomorrow is McGilligan doesn't like sunshine law and wants to tell all.
I welcome that. I'm a one-man.
First
band.
Amendment rights.
I'm a one-man band on that. I don't think Gooding even agrees with me.
Get you to the point of the Supreme Court.
I'm going to lose. I've already lost on it. I mean, not directly, but I'm not going to win on that. Okay, any other questions about sunshine? Oh, I got one. This is my favorite part. Can't do secret ballots. We don't do secret ballots here. But here's the other thing that would get you in trouble. I'm saying it would get you in trouble because the lady that writes the sunshine manual for the, we get the, Jimmy and I are in the clerk's office, they may even give me all, we get the new government sunshine law every year. The lady that writes it for the Attorney General's office is actually very helpful. You can call her directly and ask her public records or sunshine law questions. But one of the things they're having a little bit of an issue with, they're trying to look for, is private conversations going on during the meeting. So if you're sitting here at a public meeting and you want to lean over and talk about, are you going to the Gator football game this weekend, that's fine. if you come to the microphone, you start saying at the meeting, one of your fellow councilmen, that you don't like this zoning or whatever, you know, that's potentially a violation of sunshine law. The public is supposed to be having the benefit of all your thoughts and your, so secret communication about pending public matters in a public meeting that nobody can hear or see, like passing notes, things like that, that could get you in trouble, so shouldn't do that. Abstention from voting, unless you have an actual conflict and you announce a conflict and you fill out the form, by law, you've got to vote, and you can't abstain from voting, and I love that statute, because it makes politicians take a stand, and so a lot of politicians sometimes would abstain from voting. Our president was quite famous for that. He voted present a huge amount of times. I don't know when he was in the Illinois legislature, he voted present. And a lot of people would, his detractors would say that he was doing it because he didn't want to vote on one way or the other on a controversial issue and have one side or the other mad at him. Y'all don't have that luxury. If you don't have a conflict, you've got to vote. And FAR statute 286.012 says you got to vote. So be loud, be proud when you vote. What are the violations? What are the consequences? You violate the sunshine law. There are criminal penalties. You can be removed from office. You can actually go to jail for up to 60 days. I'm proud to say none of my councilmen have ever gone to jail. None of my councilmen have ever been fined. None of them have ever been charged with a sunshine law violation. So I want to keep my perfect record. So it's like the ethics law. If you have any doubts about it, give Jimmy or I a call, and then we'll deal with that. Any questions about sunshine? Okay, the next and last topic I wanted to talk to you about was, I think we gave you a handout. It's just a brief review of the charter powers and duties of council, mayor, and the city manager. Does everybody have that little one in front of you? I've just called these out of the charter. The charter, probably telling you something you already know, but the charter is sort of like the city constitution, and the ordinances are sort of like statutes that Congress would pass. So our big general broad law is set forth in a large extent to the charter. Now, that's been eroded over the years because of some legislative changes to kind of want to put most everything in the ordinances now, not in the charter, with some exceptions. But we still have a charter, and that charter, to the extent it's still effective, those areas are still effective, they take precedence over our code of ordinances. So that's a short way of saying it is, you can't have an ordinance that's at odds with a charter provision. If there's an interpretation where the charter says this and the ordinance says that, the charter is going to trump what the ordinance says. So there is a theme to our charter that runs through a number of the charter provisions, and it starts with, I think, in section 203, the general powers and duties. And it says that all powers of the city shall be vested in the council. Now, I want to focus on the word council. It doesn't say all powers of the city shall be vested in the individual councilman. It says council. So it's council as a body, not the individual councilman acting alone. And that's the way it should be. You're a legislative body. You act as a body. And nobody wants a situation where the council is saying do one thing and another, and an individual councilman is undermining that. The beauty of it, the grandeur, the beauty of just our whole democracy is, and just on a micro level here, is you can have a 3-2 vote on something, and it's the will of council that you do what the majority says, the three votes say, and the other two, even though they didn't vote for it, support the will of council to do whatever the majority directed. that's a win-win, you'll lose some mentality, but I think it's, it runs through our whole, all our democracy, so I think that's an important point to focus on. The only powers that aren't vested in council are those otherwise provided by law or in the charter, and we actually have in our charter some powers vested in other members here, and that would be specifically the city manager, the mayor, and the chief of police, city attorney, city clerk, and internal auditor, who directly work for you, but they have some unique powers themselves. But other than those limited exceptions, all power is vested with you. So that flows into the next portion, which is section 204, and subsection B says, neither the council nor any of its members shall in any manner dictate the appointment or removal of city administrative officers or employees. That duty is given to the city manager. You have the right to appoint the city manager, but he in turn has the right and duty to appoint his department heads and his employees. And it's sort of a, it's a chain, it's just a basic chain of command thing. You've got, you know, the elected body picking their man, and this guy or woman in the past, but in this case it's Mr. Brower. You've picked him, he's got the duty at that point to go pick the people he thinks best and put them in the position of authority that they need to be in to accomplish the goals you set for him. Now, that doesn't mean you can't voice your pleasure or displeasure with Mr. Brower's selections. You can tell him what you think, that you don't think the particular department head's, you know, doing a good job, or it is doing a good job, whatever. You can voice your opinion, you just can't countermand his authority in directing those employees. And if you think about that, that's really a pretty good thing, because once again, it goes back to powers are vested in the council. And you want to speak with one voice as council, you speak with one voice to Mr. Brower, whoever the city manager is, and then you go from there. Subsection C of that same charter provision talks about interference with administration, and except for investigations and inquiries, which I'll talk about in a second. You cannot interfere with the employees and how they go about doing the job. That's once again left up to Mr. Brower, in case of the police department, of course, the chief. But you can't do that. Now, that one's a continuation of the same theme of you speak as a council, you speak to Mr. Brower. But this one, I think, goes both ways. It's unfair to the employees. You can't have two masters, and it's unfair for employees to have Mr. Brower saying, do this, and then an individual councilman telling them to do otherwise. That puts them in a very untenable position as the employees. Who are they supposed to, you know, who are they supposed to obey? That nobody would want to be put in that position. And then the other thing is, if an individual councilman is telling an employee what to do, then it may not be the will of council. So you can actually have really three different bosses: council, individual councilman, Mr. Brower, all telling them three different things, and that's not fair to them. They should once again talk to with one voice. Now, we've always had a tradition here of councilmen and the mayor, you know, being able to freely talk to department heads about I need this information or whatever, and I think, you know, as long as that's all it is, that's fine. I think probably as a courtesy, Mr. Brower should be informed of it, you know, number one, and he may, I suspect, sometimes may say, you know, let me get Larry Novak in here to tell you about that, because he knows more about that than me, or, you know, would you go visit with Larry about that, and he'll tell you everything you know. He knows more about it, and that's fine. I think sometimes, you know, when they get contacted, they may think, because of the nature of the questions you're asking them, that you want them to take a certain action, and that's something I think you need to guard against, to make sure that when you are talking to the department heads or whatever, that, you know, you're making sure that you're just gathering information, and, you know, and Mr. Brower knows about it, and this is the easiest, most efficient way for you to get that information. it's not, and the council's not, hands are not tied, if you go to the next page in section 2.09, if you're concerned about the way things are being run in a particular department, you have the right as a council, and once again, it's council's body, to investigate any particular department and do whatever you think is necessary to get to the bottom of whatever you think the problem is. And that includes taking, you know, taking testimony under oath from employees. So, so on one hand, you're not supposed to be talking to employees and telling them what to do, but if you feel strongly enough that something's amiss, you've got a vehicle in the charter that allows you as a council to go deal with that directly and do it in a formal way. The mayor, his duties and powers are set forth in 3.03, and he has a number of duties, but my suspicion is that every mayor I've served for and every council probably believes the most important duty of the mayor is his relationship to the police department. He has charge and control under the charter of the police department. He nominates the chief of police, and council then approves that appointment or doesn't. They've always approved him. So he has great, he's the functional equivalent of the city manager for all things at the city of Cattle Police Department. And his duties and powers are set forth in there. It doesn't say that in the duties and power section, but it's also a limitation on the mayor's duties and powers. It sets forth what he does and what he can do, and because it doesn't have other stuff in it, by implication, is he can't do things unless he's given that duty, and it falls within the duties and powers of the mayor under section 3.03. Obviously, the mayor can veto ordinances and stuff, but I would suspect that Mayor Gwynn's probably 75% of your time is probably police department.
Probably.
75%+ of your time is probably police department, is it not? So an autopilot.
Chief lets them be police officers, and I let him be the chief. Let him do his job.
Anyway.
Very, very little.
And then finally, the continuing with the theme of, you know, of the chain of command is 5.01, which is the general provisions. Council can establish any departments it chooses. And once again, it reinforces that the departments and officers are under the supervision of the city manager. Probably wasn't telling you anything y'all didn't know about that, but it's always nice to go over again. So any questions about charter and duties and responsibilities? Okay.
Here. Have you gone over Kenny's?
That's you.
Okay.
I got a videotape, so you need to get up here.
Oh, okay. You ever sit over there? Oh, look, Pat, you've been Jimmy Gooding all this time. I'm insulted. I asked Pat to let me talk about a subject that's not near and dear to my heart, but one that's becoming more and more important and difficult to comply with, and that is the prohibition on ex-party communications on quasi-judicial decisions. Council makes a number of decisions throughout the meeting. Most of them are legislative decisions, whether or not to pass an ordinance, tax levels to establish, anything where you're adopting a law. Some of them are more characterized as transactional or business decisions. Some of the reports that you receive from the electric director, things like that. There is a category of decisions that you participate in that are known as quasi-judicial decisions. Quasi, I'm sure it comes from Greek or Latin, and I think it means about or almost, and judicial obviously meaning judicial. And in those, you're kind of acting like a judge, where you are making a decision on how to apply the law that you establish in your legislative function to a particular issue before you. Classic examples of that would include the nuisance abatement board proceedings that Pat occasionally brings to y'all. The most frequent application of that, however, is zoning decisions. All of your zoning decisions are quasi-judicial.
whether it is to assign a particular zoning classification to a property, to grant a special exception, special use permit, or any other application of the zoning code. Now, that contrasts with comp plan amendments. Even though there used to be a great debate among the courts as to whether comp plan amendments were like zoning quasi-judicial, the Florida Supreme Court has held that no, they're not. Those are legislative because they're establishing the broad classification of land use under which you will apply the specifics of the zoning. After the Supreme Court held that, there was then some debate about whether small-scale comp plan amendments were legislative or quasi-judicial. The Supreme Court finally said no, they're legislative too. So you could have the irony of having a two-acre comp plan amendment being legislative, whereas a 400-acre, or however big the Trinity Lane, I don't want to get too specific here, project is, but that on the zoning on that would be quasi-judicial.
So but the land use is not the zoning, correct?
The land use is not the zoning. The land use is the comp plan. So, but my point is, it doesn't matter the size of the parcel. It just matters what you call it. Now, when a decision is quasi-judicial, that means a number of things apply. The procedure is more formal. Even though we don't have much cross-examination or people being sworn at zoning hearings, if anyone ever asked for somebody to be sworn and subjected to cross-examination, I would advise the president that we ought to require that. But there's a way to avoid that too, as I'll explain in a little bit. The most important day-to-day issue, and by the way, the clerk's office is very good about including on the agenda matters that are quasi-judicial and others. That will alert you to one of the most important ramifications of quasi-judicial, and that is your inability to engage in ex parte communications with anyone. Kent, I'm sorry, Mayor.
It used to be, and maybe we changed it. It used to be we could talk to people if we chose to. Now I think we changed it where we can't whether we want to or not. Is that correct?
No, you're never supposed to.
But we could.
There's a way you can do it that we've brought to your attention for the last 10 years or so.
Right.
And y'all have chosen not to do it, but I'm going to give you a real hard sell. I'm going to step down from being just your legal advisor to suggesting a real course of action for you here because it's becoming more and more difficult.
Right.
And that's a good segue. Ex parte, again, Greek or Latin, from or outside of parties, is a term that came up in the judicial setting. And what it meant that was that a lawyer could not communicate with the judge other than in the courtroom. You go into a hearing, you don't want your opponent to call up the judge and say, oh, I forgot to mention this argument here, because you don't have the opportunity to address it. That never, to local government's knowledge, was an issue in many local government cases until the Jennings decision came down in the early 1990s. There, it was either Dade County or Miami, I get confused, they had a zoning decision. The developer's lawyer had lobbied the council or commission members heavily. The opponents of the project didn't know that had gone on, and thus they did not know at the zoning commission meeting or the county commission or city council meeting what arguments to address. They then found out about the communications and sued, and to the surprise and chagrin of many local government attorneys who always thought that that type of communication was protected by the First Amendment, the appellate court said that type of communication is wrong. It is an ex parte communication, and it is unfair to the other side because they don't know what was said to you, and thus they don't know what to address. For example, let's talk about in one that's passed. Mayor, have you signed the ordinance for the rezoning on 22nd? And
yeah, I've already signed.
Okay, well, if it was still pending, I wouldn't leave it up there. But let's say that that special exception was that zoning decision was coming before y'all in a PD. And let's say that the developer, let's say that Steve, and this, none of this happened, but let's say that Steve Gray called you up and said, hey guys, you really need to understand that the only way this right turn lane is going to get built is if we get approved. Now, that's in fact true, but nonetheless, it may not be something that comes out of a public meeting. The other side then would not know to say, hey, wait a minute, we don't care if that right turn lane's there. We're willing to live with it as it is, or if that right turn lane needed, the city ought to build it, regardless of whether this project goes ahead. So the each side to a zoning case needs to know what the other side is telling y'all so that they can know to address those arguments and sometimes how to address them. Now, we've rocked along trying to live with these rules for a pretty good while, and we've done pretty well with it. We've never gotten challenged. We've never gotten any trouble with it. But it's getting more and more difficult to do so. Let me say one more thing about this. This prohibition on ex-party communications is not a criminal or wrongful act on your part. It's not anything that you're doing wrong if you talk to somebody about it. But what the courts say is it gives rise to a presumption of prejudice and requires us to prove in court that you were not affected by the ex-party communication. Now, I don't know how easy or hard that's going to be to do because we never had to do it, but I can see some real problem with trying to prove a negative. So we'd like to avoid that problem. The legislature, when this issue came up, the legislature knew it was going to be a problem, and they adopted a statute at that time that allows local governments but does not require them to adopt an ordinance that removes the presumption of prejudice from ex-party communications. In essence, what it says is, if y'all adopt an ordinance, and under it you do a number of things, including establishing a procedure for making sure that any ex-party communications that you received are brought to the attention of the public, and there's ways to do that, including sending emails to the city clerk, making notes of your communications with people, so that and getting those to the clerk so that she can include them in the agenda packet, or bringing them to the council meeting. But if y'all have an ordinance that establishes procedures, then the presumption of prejudice does not arise, because pursuant to those procedures, you are curing any possibility of harm that is created by those ex-party communications. My concern is that in this digital age, it is impossible to immunize y'all from ex-party communications. When these people email you about these projects, you're going to open your email, more than likely. You're not going to look at the heading of it and say, oh, I bet that concerns that project at 22nd Avenue and 36th, and I better not open it. More than likely, you're going to do the natural thing. You're going to open it, and bingo, there's the ex-party communication. Now, we can continue to rock along as we have, and we can continue to encourage y'all to bring those to the meetings, and we'll read them and whatnot, but I'm just telling you, it's getting more and more difficult. If y'all recall on that 36, there was an email from Mr. Gibney that I wasn't sure that Greg and them had, so we read it out loud at the meeting. I mean, that's kind of inefficient. Whereas if we get it ahead of time, the clerk can put it in the agenda packet, or we can make a stack up there. It's getting almost impossible on some decisions. Let me give you an example. I don't want to talk anything about the particulars of it, but y'all have a hearing coming up in May where you're going to consider an override of the mayor's veto on a comp plan amendment. Legislative, you can talk to people all day long, but at the same meeting, there's going to be a zoning decision to talk about the plan development zoning. You can talk about the comp plan, you can't talk about the PD. Now, that's going to make your communication somewhat awkward at best, but I trust that y'all will do your best to comply with it. And fortunately, with all the lawyers involved in it, they're, you know, more than likely not going to worry about it, figuring that they'll address the arguments. But my point is that it's becoming more and more difficult to comply with the Jennings requirement. And as an advocate, I am encouraging you to let us draft an ordinance for your consideration, because this is going to be an ongoing problem, and I would like for you to at least have an opportunity to look at some procedures that will avoid the prejudice that arises from them. In fairness, though, past councils have decided not to. They didn't perceive it as that big a problem, or sometimes they like to say, I don't want to talk to you about a zoning case. But you can still do that even if we have an ordinance, because it's still somewhat of a hassle for you to comply with the procedures of it. Mr. Mayor?
Am I under the same rule since I have no vote, but can veto that I can't talk to him?
And, you know, that's a darn good question. Because of your veto power on those, I would encourage you not to have the communications with him. Mayor, before you were mayor, who was it? I can't remember who vetoed the Ms. Rich, you know where Thad Boyd's office is up there?
That was EL
vetoed that. Steve Gray challenged it, claiming the mayor couldn't veto comp plan amendment ordinances because the statute doesn't contemplate them. But it's apparent to me that you're hearing and basing your decision on what's said at a public meeting. And so I would encourage you on quasi-judicial things that you can veto, and some of them are,
right,
but quasi-judicial things you can veto that you not have ex parte communications. Right. I don't want to be arguing in Daytona about whether it's a ex parte probative communication or not.
I would agree with you.
Yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, just like you're influencing their decision to vote yay or nay on an issue, you're influencing my decision whether I should veto something or not.
So anyway, I am, in, until we adopt such an ordinance, you're going to just have to do your best. If you get an ex parte communication, print it out, get it to the clerk. If you forget to do that, bring it to the meeting. If somebody calls you on the phone or sees you at, in the public, write down their name and a brief summary of what you discussed, and let's get it to the clerk in the meantime, until we can adopt a more formal ordinance. But I'm going to need one of y'all, I would request at least one of y'all to tell me to draft something for you to look at, because I'm just seeing this is a bigger and bigger problem. And Ty, it's also becoming a problem for the PNC members. They're getting swamped, but on these controversial decisions, I mean, they got to vote too.
Yep.
And they're having to comply with this, so now we have to worry about them, and I'm getting calls from them about who they can talk to and what. I mean, it's just becoming an issue complying with these things. The good news is if we have an ordinance that's written down, it's presumably easier for everybody to follow rather than try and deal with on this ad hoc basis.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the reason you're calling a judicial is because you're like a judge, but just like anybody knows that, you know, some cases in the newspaper about a murder trial, you're not going to go up to, you know, Judge whoever, Lambert, and say, hey, Judge, what do you think about that guy, you know, when he shot him, shoot him twice or three times or, you know. You just don't do that, you know, and you don't talk about the case.
Right. But in fact, that public doesn't know that about y'all because you're elected officials,
right?
And they have the First
As
Amendment right to petition you.
As are they.
Yeah, but it's still a little different. They don't.
Right.
It's hard for the public to understand the quasi-judicial aspect of a zoning decision.
Jimmy, I for one would like you to possibly work on something like that,
okay,
and bring it back to us, and let's take a look at it in depth.
All right. I'd really appreciate it because it's just, I'm just, you know, more and more worried that someday, and it doesn't even have to be important, but because it gives rise to a presumption of prejudice, it's going to be a hassle if it ever comes up.
Yeah, I just want to look at it. So, I mean, you know, talking about it here, but if we get something on paper,
okay,
we can take a look at it, see whether it's something we can do.
All right. Any questions or comments on, Pat had additional information in the outline about other aspects of quasi-judicial. They're generally well known. I think you already know them. Mm-hmm. One thing interesting, that this state of law on what is quasi-judicial and what isn't is really messed up. The courts have said that a decision on a bid protest is not quasi-judicial. I don't care what the courts have said. We're going to encourage y'all to act as if it is quasi-judicial, because I think those cases are clearly wrong, and I don't want to be the lawyer citing the old cases and then losing on appeal. So that this whole area of law is in some sort of disarray, but the clerk does a good job about indicating what's on there, what's quasi-judicial and what isn't. I always look at it to make sure there's nothing new coming up.
Okay. You finished with your party? You still got some more?
I'm done.
You're done? Mr. Brower, you have one more thing?
Yes, we have one more thing. It should take just a couple moments. Recall during the council retreat, council asked staff to bring forward all potential business items relating to the Marion County School Board to council's attention. And we have one such business item I want to bring forward at this time for your thoughts.
Why are we recording this?
We recorded their part. So it could be shown at Planning Commission and the other boards.
Not recording.
I mean, the video.
Oh, she recorded the other thing.
Okay, good.
Good afternoon. I'm Alan Phelps with the Telecommunications Department of the City of Ocala. And Matt had asked me to come today and kind of talk about a contract that we're trying to get in with Florida Cable. They are a cable provider in Marion County. They also do telecommunications, just like what the telecommunications with the city does. They recently were one of the bidders for a, to be able to provide telecommunications services for Marion County School System. They actually won the bid, and when they did so, they came to us and asked if we could help them with these, some of the connections within Marion County.
And I have a map to kind of show you a little bit about what we're doing. This is the schools.
So you're talking about, well, I'm holding.
Okay. This shows the schools that we are actually going to try to
help them make the connections to. It's not all of the schools that they're serving, it's just the ones that are in our service territory, our fiber service territory. And we are contracting with them. We're actually a subcontractor with Florida Cable, who is, you know, who has won the bid with Marion County School System. There's 28 schools that we're involved with, and this contract is for a 12-month period. It is set to generate about $168,000 for the city of Ocala for telecommunications in that one-year period. They have the bid for 3 years, and when 12 months comes around, we'll renegotiate or whatever the case is. And right now, we're in the process of trying to make those connections for them. And like I said, we're trying to get this contract signed. Before we can do so, of course, council has to make the approval for the for that contract for us to move forward. And that's where we are right now.
Well, Matt, we can't make a formal decision on the contract today.
No, well, I'm not asking you to.
This is just either. Informational?
That is correct. Informational.
Yeah, I have a question. How much is it going to cost us to do this? You're telling me how much is we're going to get, but how much is it going to cost?
We're building 13,000 feet of fiber. It is going to be not to exceed $100,000. So what's going to happen is with this contract, and with the amount of money that we're getting for this contract, it's going to pay for itself in around 8 months or less. We don't have all the final numbers.
But you're talking about a $60,000 profit.
Right, for the first year.
But not $160,000.
No, right.
But then the second year.
The second year is pure profit.
Pure profit.
The second year, yeah. The first year isn't.
Right.
And we only got a 12-month lease on that first year.
Right.
Mr. Gilligan, can you talk a little bit about, you know, this? How's this contract going to work with the school board? Do you have any insight on that?
Aren't they going to pay it?
Well, I don't know. When I originally, you can correct me if I'm wrong, originally the city was going to bid on this itself to be the contractor for the entire thing. This is just a subcontract lease of our fiber for the bidder that was the. It wasn't a low bid, it was a request for proposal. But they've got submissions from a number of providers. Florida Cable was the one they selected under the request for proposal. They in turn now want a contract with us, and that contract's worth over $1 million, I believe.
For them, yes.
With the school board. I don't know why we didn't bid it, but we did. And so they now need a portion of our dark fiber to incorporate in this overall larger bid with the school board of $1 million+. I have asked Tiffany to get for me, and she has sent to me, the proposals from the other bidders to the school board. What I wanted to try to find out was, even though it was a request for proposal, what the pricing was going to be from, let's say, bidder number one and bidder number two. So let's say Florida Cable was $1.5 million. And part of that 1.5, they were paying us this $14,000 a month to lease the dark fiber. If the second lowest bidder was $2 million, if we say no, then the school board presumably would have to go. Now, we'd be out the $14,000. We wouldn't be out the cost, but we'd be out the profit. The school board would then ask to go to the next bidder at $2 million. It just cost them $500,000 because we said no. And I don't know what the numbers are, but somebody's going to crunch that. But my other thinking was this, need to remind council that as to the stormwater fees, the reason the school board continues to say they don't owe them is because we don't have a written contract with them, and they refuse to give us a written contract. They want a contract, obviously, in writing with Florida Cable, and Florida Cable, in turn, wants to contract with us in writing to provide those services. I'm currently researching the issue about whether we can tell Florida Cable, we're not going to sell it to you for $14,000 a month. We'll sell it to you for $14,000 a month, plus a surcharge that has to be paid directly by the school board. And that surcharge, I would suggest, would equal the monthly stormwater fee. Now, that's something for y'all to discuss, and we may or may not be having some ongoing discussions with the school board representatives or representatives here about that very issue coming up. But it just seems to me that you should at least consider how you want to deal with this, given the ongoing dispute about the stormwater and the lack of contract.
Are there other cable providers out there that don't need to use our fiber optics?
The second lowest out was the city of Leesburg. Mm-hmm. Who are the other ones?
I mean, like a Cox Cable or a...
Pretty much any of them can do that. There's only one provider right now that actually has fiber to the schools. That's the one that's serving them right now, essentially.
Right.
And any cable provider that wanted to do this would very much benefit by coming to us to provide this service, because we have fiber very close to all of these schools. So most of them would want to do that.
So they could just say, we'll just stay with what we have, and that's it.
Could be. I don't know. I mean, I don't. I've requested, and Tiffany has given me some of the bids put in. Not bids. I'm using the term bid generically. Their response to the request for proposal. So when you get it and you look at it, it's hard to. It's not like we'll just do it for this price. It's a proposal, and it has different components to it, and it's a little bit difficult to read through and try to figure out what it would be if it was the second or third or fourth bidder that had to do it. My sense is, and I think Mr. Phelps has confirmed, is that they'd all want to come to us because it'd be cheaper to lease it from us than build it themselves, and hence the price to the school board would be higher, it would seem to me, because of that, if they had to go build it out themselves rather than lease it from us. Now, on one hand, if it costs us $100,000 in the first year and we're making, you say $168,000, the first year, and then if you renew it after that, then money you're not receiving. It's revenue above cost that you're not receiving. But, if it's going to cost the school board extra money, maybe we all should be, one of the reasons that maybe we should all be sitting down and talking, because it seems to me the principle of this whole idea of a written contract seems to be a play here, where they certainly want a written contract. And they want their provider, Florida Cable, to have a written contract with us so they know that it's being provided, but they won't give us a written contract for the stormwater utility.
Because you would have to pay it then.
You can go to them and say, look, we're going to, it's a $10,000 a month surcharge on the Florida Cable contract that has to be paid by the school board, or no deal, or some variation of that. Maybe they, I don't know how they respond, but you don't know until you throw it out there.
Ms. Rich?
Why didn't we do a request for a proposal?
There were several reasons. One of them was all of the schools that are outside of our service territory. We would have had to turn around and do the same thing in order to get connectivity for all the schools that we don't have fiber to. That would have been a very major undertaking for us to do that. We don't really have the manpower to do that. Another thing is something called the USF fund that we have to contribute to. We're not a member of that right now. If we were to bid on this the next go-round, which, by the way, if we were to do this go-round to build all this fiber, it would give us that ability to bid on this the next time. And if we are then a member of the USF funding, we would be able to make the bid the next time.
So the purpose of this is to, one, to bring it to your attention. The contract will be on next Tuesday's meeting agenda. Want to get your thoughts about this particular potential relationship and kind of get your thoughts as to this particular business undertaking.
Well, from my standpoint, I wanted to see what Pat comes back with when he looks at all of the contracts and things like that. I don't necessarily want to delay the fact that it's coming back, but I want to, you know, I do want to give him some time to look at it.
I put it on the agenda. I'd like to read the materials and mm-hmm. your memorandum that you always prepare on agenda items.
Okay.
And then formulate my thoughts from that point. It's just hard to kind of get it dropped in my lap and
absolutely
come to a conclusion today.
Fair enough.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. But what I'm hearing you say is proceed forward, put it on the agenda, take action potentially next Tuesday.
Put it on the agenda.
Okay. Right. Okay. We'll do it.
Okay. Oh, thank
Council
you.
President, that's all I've got.
Thank you.
Anybody have anything else?
Yeah.
Okay.
Did
we're
you
adjourned.
Say you don't think we should do it because
oh,
of the
hold on. Stop we're not adjourned.
We're not.
Oh,
go ahead.
I was asking Pat, did you say you don't think we should do it because of the stormwater issue?
No, council, no, I'm not, it is a bargaining chip, and we're supposed to be having a meeting with the school board here shortly.
The 8th.
It's probably going to get, not be that day, but that was the day we officially put on there, but shortly, if they agree, we're supposed to have a meeting. I would like to discuss with them. I don't, you know, the school board, as probably y'all know, asked to have an electric connection done for a building that was previously leased by, I think, a cable company. They wouldn't give us a written contract, so we said, we're not connecting your electric. They wanted to put their computers in that building, their servers in that building, and air conditioning. We didn't do it. It's a shame that our relationship with the school board has come to that, where we have to tell another governmental body, we're not hooking your electric up to your building you wanted to use for computers because you won't give us a written contract. What business in the world says doesn't have the right to say to their customers, give us a written contract or you don't get it? And they apparently refuse to give us a written contract and therefore don't have electric to that building. That's one thing I think that should be pointed out to Mr. James when we meet with them, that's crazy, that's silly. You know, we should be working together, not doing this, but because you won't pay your stormwater bills, you won't give us a contract for it, you know, you've put us in that position. This is somewhat akin to that. Ultimately, it's y'all's decision about how you deal with it, and there's certainly pros and cons. You lose revenue on one hand, but maybe they have to pay more on the other because we aren't playing. Or we may have the right to say, we're going to charge you $14,000 a month plus a $10,000 surcharge that has to be paid by the school board. You know, you don't pay stormwater, you'll pay more for the electric fiber then. You know, we don't want to have to play that game. That seems silly, but I want to give y'all, so I'm not saying yes or no, a direct answer to your question. I want to give y'all every bargaining chip possible when dealing with the school board. And I also want those chips to reflect the absurdity of the relationship between the school board and the city council, that we're not driving that issue. They're the ones that's driving that issue. And if they want to continue down that path, they're going to continue, I believe, to have a poor relationship with this council, which is not in their best interest and not in ours.
Did they accept your letter already? I'll give you a time.
Have not heard from them. Well, I take that back. She emailed me about an extension of time to file another matter. In this case, and another issue, had nothing to do with that. So I've had an email exchange with her about that that I've not heard from about the meeting.
Well, I'd be pleasantly surprised if they do want to set up a meeting. That'd be contrary to everything that they've said in the past. So, anyway. Anybody well, have maybe, anything
they
further?
They may be more interested in having a meeting if they know this is something that's an issue. Mm-hmm.
If they don't have the money, and they may have to put up another $500,000 or more to get this thing done.
Mr. Malver, I don't know how much it would cost. My sense is it's going to cost a lot more.
That's right.
Otherwise, Florida
and
cable.
They're yelling for money anyway.
Florida Cable wouldn't have come to us and asked to lease the dark fiber.
Well, that's the information I would hope we could find out.
Yeah.
I mean, we're in the business of leasing it. I mean, we've got it there. It's just sitting there. We're in the business of leasing it. We need the money. They need to be paying cheaper prices. You know, it just seems to me it's gotten to the point where it's absurd. But, you know, y'all need to know that. And if, you know, y'all need to make a decision how you want to deal with it. And,
well, you need to somehow paint the picture of what's really going on, because it's going to be painted in the newspapers. We're gouging the taxpayers of Marion County, making them pay another $500,000.
Well, I use that number by way of example. So
that's ballpark, quite a bit.
I don't know, but I just the thing I keep having a hard time wrapping my hand around is this whole we're not going to give you a contract. We want the services, but we're not going to give you a contract. That just has never made sense to me. It's the most bothersome part of the whole thing to me is just not going to give you contracts, because if we do, we got to pay for it.
But they require Florida Cable to have a contract.
They require everybody they do business with to have a contract. As do we.
Part of the kids that go to school.
As do we. We insist that we have a written contract with everybody that does business with the city of Ocala. We insist on it. So.
You don't have any loan documents or anything, Jay, down at your bank, do you, that you make people sign?
Oh, yeah.
Plenty of them.
Does anybody have anything else for Pat?
No, but we should be able to give them the contract and tell them to sign it if they want to do business with us.
Well, I understand we're also in a sub position here. We are not the primary provider of Florida Cable, and so Pat, you're going to opine on what
surcharges.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, we're adjourned.
Okay. Good.
See what happens. I'm feeling good.
Would y'all have to eat back there?
Okay.
Sandwiches?
Yeah, rolls. I saw the eye roll.